this wording, yes. Notify users instead of this. There is somewhere somebody who's going to regulate the volume, and he has promised that he will turn the volume down while I'm singing and up while I'm dancing during the course of the evening, so you can follow along. Thank you very much, Nancy, Daniel. I'm glad you're all here. And thank you for mentioning the book, although I'm not here to sell Six Nightmares. That's Six Nightmares. That's not why I'm here, although it does have a nice red cover, and it does look good on a coffee table, and there are only 197 more shopping days until Christmas, as I calculate. But quite seriously, I hope you don't buy the book. I hope you, even if you were tempted to, that you take the same amount of money and contribute it to UNICEF, which is the U.S. Fund is the best organization. Seriously, the best organization that I've ever worked with, except for the NSC staff, of course, in the first Clinton term. I want to talk for a while about, and now I'm looking forward to discussion, about terrorism and about why I believe that what I call modern terrorism, existential terrorism, is so very dangerous. Explore some of the origins of it. And all of this is going to be rather dismal, grim, even frightening for all of us. So I want to say at the beginning that despite the somber topic, I am in fact an optimist. And I'm an optimist for two reasons. One is that history shows that in the long run, terrorism does not succeed, and it will not succeed in this case, difficult as the years ahead are going to be. And the second reason I'm an optimist is, as Nancy said, because I am a Red Sox fan. And if you are a Red Sox fan, you have to be an optimist. So I'm here to tell you this is the year, the first since 1918, when we do it. I just want to talk a little about the relationship between globalization, which we all know and I won't take the time to define, and terrorism, and discuss why globalization helps produce terrorism, why globalization makes terrorism more dangerous, but also why I believe in the end globalization will defeat the kind of terrorism that we are seeing now. How does it help produce terrorism? Well, it's a cliche that it helps produce it because through globalization you have cultural inroads which local cultures then resist and react against. Anybody know what the most popular television program is in the world? What? Baywatch. And what was it before Baywatch? Dallas. You can see why there's a cultural reaction as a result of all of this. I've often wondered if instead of Dallas, the United States wouldn't have been better off if it had been Boston, with people sitting around drinking tea and not doing anything in particular, and it would just been, it would have been a more attractive, I think it was Philadelphia. No, because I've seen Philadelphia fans at hockey games, and it's too ugly. Anyway. But more, this is trying to curry favor with an audience who's attacking Philadelphia fans. The more profound backlash, however, is not the cultural backlash, but a political backlash, a backlash against values, values of democracy, values of individual choice, values including, as I will discuss, the separation of church and state. And this backlash helps to create what I call existential terror or modern terror. This is not my invention, but it helps explain the kind of threat that we're facing. 10 or 15 years ago, and still to some degree in a number of terrorist organizations, the point of terror was to create a political, to reach a political goal. the PLO when it was in the business, the IRA, etc. Increasingly today, terrorism is not aimed at a specific goal, and is therefore not trying to, or terrorist leaders, and are therefore not trying to achieve a specific purpose, so much as they are simply lashing out in hatred, personal hatred, religious hatred, whatever, against a modern world that they don't like. Theodore Kaczynski, the Unabomber, who was doing this, he, by the way, was a year behind me in college. As I note in the book, I don't remember him. More importantly, he didn't remember me. Or Timothy McVeigh, or the leaders to a somewhat lesser degree, but still the same idea of Al-Qaeda and elsewhere. They are simply acting out of hatred. They are lashing back. As Kaczynski said in his diary, I don't believe in anything. I simply want revenge. Why does this make them so dangerous? Well, because, first of all, they act anonymously. They don't want to advertise what they're doing. They don't have to because it's not for a cause. They simply want to destroy. And secondly, because their purpose is, by and large, simply destruction, and because they don't have a political goal, they are more attracted to weapons of mass destruction. Because they are not self-deterred. If you are trying to use terror for a political goal, you're not going to take those actions that will be so horrible that there will be a backlash that will damage your political purpose. Whereas if you're acting anonymously and don't care about the backlash you simply want to destroy, then you will be more attracted to weapons of mass destruction. I want to take the time here to run through what those weapons are. I did the book, started in 1999, because after I'd left government, I was very worried that while we had made a start on trying to deal with the possibility of a terrorist use of a weapon of mass destruction, we weren't doing enough. And I used to give speeches and make people's palms sweat talking about chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, or, as increasingly concerned people in Washington now, so-called dirty bombs, in which you could take radioactive waste or radioactive materials, wrap them around a conventional explosive, wouldn't kill a lot of people in the initial blast, but would create a radioactive zone that would be could be devastating. But let me note a fourth weapon of mass destruction that is not commonly thought of as such, but I believe is, and that is the computer. We tend to think of computer attacks as being the reverse of what used to be known in the, I guess it was the late 60s, early 70s, the neutron bomb. Remember, which the purpose of which was to kill people and not things. We tend to think of computer attacks, and my students at Georgetown, every time I talk about this, get this little smirk on their face because they think it's cool, hacking in, etc. Well, it's not, because computers don't just kill things, they can kill people as well. They can be weapons of mass destruction. There are 5,000 critical sites around the United States, which, if knocked off, would have terrible human consequences. Or through computer attacks, you can specifically affect people by altering hospital records, infant food formulas, etc., etc. And what makes computers dangerous is that, unlike nuclear or biological or even chemical, there is a huge pool of potential terrorists out there. It is very hard to make anthrax in the dispersible form that you need to create in order to use it as a weapon, but certainly any of my students is a potential terrorist. When I point this out to them, I try to look and see which ones are doing the little smirk. In fact, this is why, and you'll remember this best from the Vietnam days, I don't trust anybody under 30 now. But it's a dangerous phenomenon, and one that we have to work on just as seriously as the other forms. So why is it that globalization makes it easier than for the terrorists to potentially get their hands on these weapons? And why does it make it harder to catch the modern terrorist? Well, their access is becoming easier because, for example, there are recipes on the internet, including sometimes American government documents, for chemical and other weapons. Because with the increased traffic across borders, our borders, as has been widely noted recently, are far more porous than they used to be. A chilling fact is that of the containers coming into the United States, somewhere, and estimates vary, somewhere between 0.5% and 5% on average are ever inspected. You don't need to build a missile to send a weapon of mass destruction into the United States. You can FedEx it, and your chances are at least 95 out of 100 that it will get through uninspected. A part of the increase in global movement of people. And in global trade, for example, with the increase in movements of chemicals, chemical precursors are moving around the world much more. Maybe not the result of globalization, but there are now 27 nations around the world that have chemical or nuclear or biological weapons, and they could use them either intentionally or they could leak into the hands of terrorists. So why does globalization make it harder to catch them? Well, in part, they're harder to catch now because, as I said, they act more anonymously. But it's also because with a wired world, they can communicate more easily, as bin Laden is good at doing, or was if he's still alive, through the internet. Because it is easier for them to organize links with criminal groups and trade off arms for money, drugs, etc. Because it is easier, as I said, to get across borders. Because with greatly increased money flows around the world, it's easier for them to launder and hide their money. And all that you read in the newspapers. Something to note here, and especially as we continue to read about intelligence failures, which there have been and will be, it is becoming increasingly hard for our intelligence community to track the terrorists for a rather simple reason. And that is, with fiber optics now, the volume of messages passing around the world is hugely increased. And that means if the National Security Agency or others are trying to monitor that traffic to find the messages of the terrorists, it is much harder to find them. In fact, let me just take a moment in defense of the intelligence community, which I think is unparalleled in the world and does a terrific job, and especially the analytical side of the CIA, who are, I believe, the best analysts of foreign societies that we have in the United States, but need to get better. What is their problem as they try to track down the terrorists? The point here is that you very seldom find the smoking gun of a message. We are going to hit the World Trade Center. You have to piece together pieces of information in the right way in order to predict the future. And if you think about it kind of as a haystack, what you're doing is you're not finding a needle in a haystack, you're finding a piece of hay in a haystack. And not just that, but you're trying to find the right three or four pieces of hay in the haystack that will add up to the prediction of a terrorist attack that you're looking for. And not only that, but as I said, the haystack is rapidly getting bigger and bigger because of fiber optics. Well, I've gone this long without really talking very much about Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, and let me do that, and let me note that he has been very much a focus of the White House and the intelligence community since at least late 1994 and 1995. I would argue that while he does indeed have a goal, unlike, say, Kaczynski, and that is expelling American influence from the Middle East, that he nevertheless is in many ways a modern existentialist terrorist, in the sense that he is not open to bargaining. He is not using terror in order to strike some sort of deal. This is, in his view, and therefore it must be in ours, also a fight to the finish. There is almost no way to deter him. There is no way to dissuade him. The difference is so fundamental that this is not like, say, working on Northern Ireland, where you could begin to split off the Sinn Féin from the IRA. Why? Why, though, Osama bin Laden and his lieutenants and the other leaders of terrorism, and I'm going to make a distinction between the leaders and the potential followers, why do they hate us? Why is this so fundamental? Well, I think it's because not of primarily of what we are doing, but it is because of what we are, and that we're not going to change. The, not bin Laden, but the Khomeini in Iran has certainly in the past called us the Great Satan. And if we contemplate the word Satan and why they use Satan, I think it's instructive. This is something that Bernard Lewis pointed out to me at a meeting once on terrorism that I had in the Situation Room. Satan was not a warrior. As I remember my Bible, Satan lost the only battle, indeed, that he ever fought. What is Satan's power? I'm sorry? Temptation. He is a tempter, and it is the temptations of American life, of our prosperity, our freedom, et cetera, that are so threatening to the bin Ladens, who have a fundamentally different view of what a society ought to look like. Why is it so different? Well, I am not an expert on Islam, but I've, especially in recent months, done some more reading on it. And the scholars I've read note that, and this is, I think, very fundamental, that for good or ill, and it is both, that the chief duty of Muslims is to create a just society. That is what Islam is about. And Muhammad preached of a wonderful, just society, including, in fact, near equal rights for women. But this duty, taken literally and to an extreme, as the fundamentalists do, means that there can be no real separation of church and state. Indeed, Karen Armstrong, in, I thought, a very, very good short book that I would recommend to you called Islam, writes that, quote, politics was therefore what the Christians would call a sacrament. There is a holy purpose to politics that we don't see. This is a noble vision, trying to create a just society on earth as your primary duty. But the problem is you can see why the great wave of democracy that has swept over the world has largely not lapped on the shores of the Middle East. Because for a fundamentalist Muslim, the politics is shaped by the word of God, not as the sum total of the individual choices of the citizens of that society. It is a fundamental difference. And so for the fundamentalists, there can be no compromise with Satan or with the temptations of this freedom. We cannot dissuade them. We cannot deter them. And as I said, this is a fight to the finish. That's the bad news. I think the good news is that we do have to make a distinction between the leaders of this terror and the potential followers. The fact is that there are many voices now in the Islamic world of moderation, of people who are looking to find ways to reconcile democracy and the precepts of Islam. We should not be listen to those who are so pessimistic that they say democracy and Islam can never coexist. In fact, parliamentary elections, Daniel knows much more about this than I do, are going to be held in Bahrain in September, October, I believe. The National Democratic Institute is training a lot of women compared to the past to run in local elections in Morocco, and of course Turkey itself is an example of a secular government, a secular state in a Muslim society. This is a struggle within Islam. We can't decide it. It will be decided by the moderates who are working for a different vision from that of Osama bin Laden. But we can make some difference. And to understand what difference we can make, I think we have to begin with asking ourselves why it is that Osama, and these are shocking polls that I've seen, why it is that Osama bin Laden is so popular throughout the Arab world right now, and why it is that his appeal could have such resonance. And this is going to take some perspective. You have to make a leap of imagination to the other side to see what is going through their minds. It reminds me a bit, I won't refer to a Phillies fan, of a Yankee fan, of course, not high intelligence, who was on a walk, and he came to a large river, and he saw on the other side of the river another Yankee fan, who by definition was not of high intelligence, and he yelled across the river, "How do I get to the other side?" And the other Yankee fan looked up and down the river, thought for a moment, and then said, "You are on the other side." Well, we need to, that is a failure of imagination, we need to see the other side. Why is he so popular? Well, I think a part of it is simply, he, in a sort of a mixed religious metaphor here, he is playing David to our Goliath. And there's a natural attraction of that, nothing we could do about it. Partly, I think it is because of anger at events in the West Bank and Gaza, events that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, like Saddam Hussein, I think quite cynically, exploit, that it has a resonance. Partly, as Tom Friedman writes so often and so well, because of their anger at corrupt and autocratic regimes whose corruption and autocracy are actually in violation of the precepts of the Quran, and whose governments are often supported by the United States. But also because while globalization has brought Baywatch over television into many of those societies, it has not brought prosperity to the Middle East. All of the non-oil exports from that vast, vast region equal the exports of Denmark. It's stunning. They are living in failed economies, statist economies. There are huge income disparities in those economies. They lack economic, political, and social mobility. No wonder there is anger among them. So will the angry and the disaffected listen to the Osama bin Ladens and who blame the West for all their ills, and in a funny way, who are acting in conjunction with the governments who are blaming the West, at least under their breath, for their own misrule, or will they listen to the reformers who can lead them into the 21st century? In the long run, I am an optimist. I'm an optimist in the short run about the Red Sox, in the long run about this, because of the nature of globalization and economic progress. It's interesting that even bin Laden has wanted the products of modernization, in the sense that he brilliantly used the internet, et cetera, but he didn't want the westernization that comes with it. Individual choice, entrepreneurial independent innovation, separation of church and state, scientific inquiry. But the fact is that you can't separate them, that modern economies require those very qualities. And in fact, the history of the Middle East is proof of this. And here, if you sense that I know almost nothing about what I'm talking about, on this specific part of it, you'll be quite accurate. But I have been struck in reading some of the history at how during our dark ages, In fact, as I think you all know, Islam was the center of civilization. The leaders in the preservation and extension of Greek philosophy, the leaders in mathematics, independent scientific inquiry, etc. And they lost it. And the question is why, as Bernard Lewis, in his excellent book, puts it, what went wrong? Well, there's many things, but ideas matter, and the intellectual context matters. And the fact is that in the 11th century, Ghazali, a Muslim philosopher and leader, taught in a very popular way, especially for the Sufis, that knowledge comes from revelation, that science comes from scripture. And this became very popular, and it was 50 years later or so that Ibn Rushd, who was a true scientist and philosopher, expert on Aristotle, taught and wrote that, on the contrary, that it is through science that you can understand God's creation. I find this quite moving, because that is almost precisely what Einstein, who was not a bad scientist and a religious man, believed as well. Ibn Rushd's writings were burned, and he was silenced. However, and the rest is history, a much more complicated history than that, but nonetheless. But the fact is, as I said, that as globalization brings the world together, simply as a practical matter, there will be no way in which the intellectual descendants of Ghazali, like Osama bin Laden, although not the same sect, will be able to find ways to have modernization without the Western values that come with it. It simply won't work. What does all this mean for the American War on Terror? Well, I think that we are, and you can see it every day in op-ed pieces and in the newspapers, etc., that we are witnessing a false debate. On the one hand, you read those who say this is a war to the finish, that has to be pursued through military means and covert action, etc., etc. And on the other hand, you hear people arguing, no, wait a minute, it is poverty and human misery that is creating terrorism, and the answer is to contribute to UNICEF. By the way, I'm gradually moving this now, if you didn't find the segue, towards my unabashed appeal for UNICEF. Nancy, you'll be pleased with me. But anyway, I think it's a false debate. The answer is both, because the former has to be applied to the leaders, and the latter has to be applied to the potential followers. We need to fight and chew gum at the same time. Again, the war against the leaders of Al-Qaeda and some of the other groups is a fight to the finish. There will be no compromise, and we have to recognize that it is going to take a long time. There are 60 to 80 Al-Qaeda networks, just Al-Qaeda networks, that need to be rolled up through military actions, covert actions, etc. This is going to take a long time, even with the cooperation of local governments. Without that cooperation, it will take forever. And on the other side, we can, in fact, I believe, have an effect. We can't decide it, and this is not about public relations. We can have an effect on the potential followers if we do four things, I believe, in particular. The first is to fight the poverty that helps to create the dangerous despair that is helping to produce terrorism in the Middle East and Central Asia and Southeast Asia and Africa and elsewhere. Consider, for example, the fact that 40% of Saudis are under 14. Their economy gets worse and worse there, and they don't get jobs, their anger is going to become greater. Consider the fact, I believe, that about 2 billion people will be coming into the world over the next 25 years, and when they get a of an age in which they're going to need jobs. Are we going to have a global economy? And will the Middle East have economies that can take care of them? How are they going to find jobs? And this is not, here's the segue, this is not just a question of jobs. It is also a question of the attitudes, the views of life of a whole generation of people around the world, and especially in the Middle East and in Islamic societies. There was a UNICEF poll that really struck me in 1997 in Kabul, which showed that 90% of the children that they interviewed believed that they would die in the fighting in Afghanistan. This is in 1997. Just imagine for a moment how those children are going to think, not just about their own lives, but about whether other people live or die either. And they will now grow up with those views in their heads and psyches. So, speaking of a UNICEF poll, let me take just a moment to talk about UNICEF, because I do believe that supporting UNICEF is, and this is not how Carol Bellamy would make the pitch, but is very much related to our fight, therefore, against terrorism. Not just because UNICEF is saving 3 million or so lives of children a year. Look at the difference. I think another way to think about it is to look at the difference that UNICEF can make in the life of one girl or boy. First, while the child is still before being born, for about a dollar, there can be a tetanus shot that can protect both the mother and the child against what we used to call lockjaw, which we never worry about anymore, but is quite prevalent around the world. So for $1, it saves lives, or this child's life. And then from ages 1 to 5, $17 can protect that girl or a boy against six-killing diseases, or even a few cents can get iodine into salt and prevent mental retardation. We sometimes think that progress is impossible, but the fact is that such immunization programs have worked. 20% of kids in the world were immunized in 1980, and today the number is about 74%. A huge increase, but it ought to be 100%. There is no excuse for it not being 100%. So for a very modest contribution, or through trick-or-treat for UNICEF or whatever, you can, in fact, save a few lives just for a very little bit of money. And you'll never know who they were. You'll never see the faces of those children, but you will know that you did it, and that's why I'm so excited about UNICEF. Let's take that girl's life then through adolescence. Because one of the things UNICEF does is to promote girls' education. And why especially girls? Well, there are 130 million kids around the world who are not in school, and two-thirds of them are girls. And this makes a difference. For each additional year a girl is in school, her wages as an adult increase by about 15%. This is good for the girls. It's good for their economies, and it's good for our interests in a world of disorder. On the train coming up, I did my required reading on other subjects, and then as a reward turned to the box scores, read the Boston box score in USA Today, and then turned to the main section of USA Today and ran into this story, "Officials Hope to Get Afghans Back to School," which is about a UNICEF campaign of $47.5 million trying to get 1.5 million Afghan children into about 3,000 primary schools this year. There's a quote from the woman who is running it saying, "This gives Afghans an alternative to a situation where the army is the biggest employer and where war is the biggest occupation." Because that is our challenge in Afghanistan, and that is why I am saying that contributing to UNICEF, in my view, is not only the right thing to do, but it is richly in our nation's interest as well. The second thing, so we need to be addressing poverty, and I think we should welcome what President Bush has said about increasing our aid programs in the last few days. The second thing I think we need to do is to be very careful as we make deals with other governments in return for their cooperation in the war on terrorism. We have to be very careful not to endorse their actions, which in fact can help create the terrorism that we are trying to work with them to defeat. We shouldn't look the other way when those governments, through their state-run schools or press, teach anti-Western venom. We shouldn't look the other way, for example, in Uzbekistan, when governments are abusing human rights in ways that are creating a backlash that can lead to terrorism. And we should be promoting democracy throughout the Middle East in a way we haven't done in recent years for diplomatic reasons by supporting democratic reformers there. A third thing that I think we need to do is to remember Theodore Roosevelt. We have a big stick. As I said, I think we should be using it. But we ought to be speaking more softly. I think when we overindulge in rhetoric, we dismay our allies, we undercut the reformers and the moderates in the Middle East, and oddly enough, we raise the bar for our own success here at home. Yes, I am. I do have an axis to grind. And finally, and fourth, I think we have to stay engaged in Middle Eastern diplomacy in a way we have not been in recent months. The point here is that this is going to take a long time. The war against the leaders is going to take a long time. The argument within Islam is not going to be resolved for a long time. So we have to understand that this is a strategic moment, rather like the late 1940s. Because this war is going to go on for a long time, the patterns that we set now in our diplomacy and other ways are likely to be with us almost for a generation or more. So they deserve debate. We are doing a service to our democracy and to our futures when we debate almost every decision that we are making now. We need to debate our defense spending, which needs to increase greatly, but we need to remember that the dollars that we're committing now mean dollars in the next 10, 15, 20 years. We need to make sure we're prepared to live with that. We need to debate it, as I said, when we enter into new diplomatic relations with other governments, because that could define our diplomacy for the next generation. And we need to debate how we are dealing with our civil liberties here at home. I believe that they are going to have to be circumscribed as a practical matter if we are going to fight the terrorists. But the burden of proof ought always to be on those who will circumscribe our civil liberties, not on those who are defending them. And they need to be debated. That is, in my view, patriotic. Because, for example, with the tribunals, unlike the precedents when Abraham Lincoln created tribunals during the Civil War, military tribunals, or when Franklin Delano Roosevelt used a tribunal against Nazi saboteurs, they were bounded in time. This war is going to go on for a long time, so we need to be very careful in the patterns that we're setting in our judicial system. And finally, because it is going to go on a long time, we have to be persistent and yet patient, because there will be victories, but there will also be defeats, and I believe there will be new horrific incidents in the United States at some point in the coming years. This may be a new kind of war, but nonetheless, it is a war. So let me end with some words of Winston Churchill. I've mentioned Abraham Lincoln. That's obligatory in the speech. I've mentioned now Winston Churchill. That's obligatory. You're supposed to mention Yogi Berra in the speech, but I don't quote Yankees. Let me finish with Churchill. And I think his words apply both to the war against terrorism and also to a refusal unnecessarily to give up our civil liberties or make concessions with other governments that are not in our long-term interests. This is a speech he gave at the Harrow School in 1941 or 43, I can't remember which. I will read you the whole speech. Don't be dismayed. I would simply note that the observers who were there watching him get up out of his chair and make his way over to the podium, a significant number of observers, but nonetheless a minority, thought that he was sober. Which perhaps explains his brevity. But the speech is as follows. Never give in. Never give in. Never, 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 never. In nothing great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense. And I don't believe the United States is going to do so. Thank you. Thank you so much, Anthony Lake, for both of our eloquence and rich speech, much to agree with and much to argue with. Let me begin with two observations and then ask you a couple questions. We don't have much time, so I'll be brief. First, I am a Red Sox fan. I grew up in Boston. Second, I admire your willingness to talk about Anzali and Ibn Rushd, actually the topics of my undergraduate thesis. But I will in turn take the risk of talking about something you really know about much more than I do, and that's about intelligence, and point out that your defense of intelligence was of the analytic side, but there's the other side. There is infiltrating and going into difficult places. One wit in the agency has said that we don't go places anymore where you get diarrhea. And perhaps the proof of this lies in the saga of John Walker Lynn, who walked into Afghanistan and met the leadership. Why wasn't American intelligence doing that? Why were we decoding internet messages and not out there doing what we really had to do in order to break through and find out what was going to happen? So let me leave it at that and invite your response. Thank you. This is a problem. It's related, first of all, to the debate that you hear often of should we be emphasizing technical means of intelligence, i.e. satellites, intercepting communications, etc., or should we be doing more human intelligence, so-called human. And in fact, I agree with, well, since you're a Red Sox fan, I agree with anything you say. You have now carte blanche completely, but I think that we did, from the mid-70s through the 80s, let the human intelligence side languish. And in fact, I can recall the first meeting with then-Governor Clinton after he got elected president. One of the points we went over and debated some, not with him, but with some of his other advisors, was exactly this. George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, and I must say some of you will know what I'm talking about, and the others I'm glad don't, who I think is the best director of Central Intelligence we could possibly have had over the last few years. I'm glad you don't know what I'm saying. I once applied for the CIA, and it didn't turn out well. In any case, he has been emphasizing both human and technical intelligence against hard targets. It takes a while to, it doesn't take long to become John Walker Lind. It does take a while to develop an agent who can go in there and who is skilled enough to do it. And I know they're working on it, but this is not a new problem. During the Vietnam War, I know when I was working on it, we had nobody in North Vietnam. We have had great difficulty in North Korea. During the Nicaraguan Civil War, we had nobody with the Sandinistas. This is not a new problem, but you're right, it is a serious problem, and we need to be addressing it. I was going to recruit anybody who wanted to be an analyst for the CIA, but I would also be glad to take names for anybody who wants to go and try to infiltrate Al-Qaeda.
The floor is open. Let me invite you to the...
Can I make one point first, which is not, please, just not questions, observations. Especially, please don't do observations disguised as questions. You know, that was a stupid point, wasn't it? Just, you
know. Okay, quick. 2 months ago, Mr. Pipes was was asked by me, what's going to happen in Iran and Iraq? He said, we're going to work, I think, on Iraq, but Iran has a budding democracy. 2 weeks ago, I asked William Sapphire, who was also in Philly, the same question, and he said, Iraq is in the crosshair. What's cooking?
I'm not the first person this administration calls to confide in, although I do talk to them from time to time, which is the way democracy ought to work. So I can't tell you exactly what's cooking. If I knew what was cooking, I wouldn't for sure tell you, but I can guess some and give you my view. I believe, and I'll just make the points, and then we could argue them if you wish, I believe that Iran is a greater threat than Iraq. But the problem is that Iran is much more difficult to deal with, both because it's much harder to imagine a military assault on Iran, and because, in fact, Iran is the third most democratic country in the world, even if the power is with the bad guys now. Attacking Iran is just not cooking right now in Washington. But I think in all the furor about Iraq, we ought not to forget that Iran, in its support for Hezbollah and now for the Palestinian Authority, in its development of weapons of mass destruction and missiles, is more dangerous, in fact, than Iraq. Is Iraq in the crosshairs? I honestly don't think that they have made a final decision, and you've been reading about all the arguments within the government. It should be in the crosshairs in the sense of, would the world be a better place off without Saddam Hussein in power in Iraq? Of course. But this is very complicated. In my view, if we were to do this kind of in a cut-rate way, let me back up for a moment. Too much of the debate over Iraq now is kind of about testosterone, and you're either for taking out Iraq or you don't dare or whatever. We need a serious debate about it in which we debate the real questions, right? And the first question, of course, is what is our purpose? And there we have to sort it out. Is the purpose to keep him from developing the weapons of mass destruction that are so incredibly dangerous? Or is it this is a very reasonable argument for this, that that's impossible and no inspectors can do it, therefore you have to take out Saddam Hussein himself? It's a serious argument either way, a practical one. Second question, how do you get rid of him then, if that is your goal? And I am very concerned that those who argue that there is a cut-rate way to do this, a cheap way to do it, that all we can need to do is arm an opposition, and then with our Air Force, we could help them become victorious, risks at least a Bay of Pigs that would be worse than the Bay of Pigs. And therefore, I believe if we're going to do it, you need to be serious about it and have the ground troops there ready if necessary. I, by the way, parenthetically believe that we should shut down the no-fly zones as we patrol them and instead declare a complete no-fly zone over all of Iraq and implement it by saying that if any military aircraft flies out of any airbase in Iraq, we will take out that airbase. Much easier to implement. And the important thing would be it takes away his air force. And if you take away his air force, it becomes easier for the one institution in Iraq that can remove him to do it, and that's the army, in my view. And all this is being debated. The final, and we're not ready yet to deploy those troops, and won't be until Afghanistan is cleared up, and then we get the necessary ammunition, et cetera, in place for the precision-guided munitions. I think a question that is not being addressed and needs to be, though, has to do with whether this would be done unilaterally or multilaterally. My concern is, yes, of course we could do it unilaterally, and if we face an existential threat, we should act unilaterally. But we need to think it through for after Saddam is gone as to what do we do then. Because you can't simply do it, as we can see in Afghanistan, and then leave. You need peacekeepers on the ground. You need to find ways to encourage a democracy to put it back together again. And if we've gone in unilaterally, unlike Afghanistan, it's very unlikely others are going to come in to help us. And I do not believe, given our force structure and posture around the world, that we can afford for a period of some years to have, 50,000 or so Americans American troops in Iraq stuck there, and we could be needing them elsewhere in the war on terrorism. These are all practical questions that have to be answered.
To your point on troop deployment, Mr. Lake, Tom Friedman came out this week advocating the installment of U.S. troops to secure the border between Israel and Palestine. Would you speak to whether you agree with that in the same vein, or some of your observations on that point?
Tom is always interesting. He got it right when he said you should be sitting down when you read this. But in fact, it was a little less dramatic than I expected then, because he never put it this way, but the context was always it is in as a part of a peace settlement by each side. So this is not an invasion by American troops. It would presumably have the not just the agreement, but be welcomed by the government of Israel and the Palestinian Authority, which makes the proposal a little less dramatic. Would a peacekeeping force be of use in the event of a withdrawal, either full or partial, from the West Bank and Gaza by Israeli troops? I think that a number of Israelis will believe, I hope I can say will rather than would, that it would be useful, and then you have to get into questions of what are the ground rules, who is it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in short, I wouldn't rule it out, but I don't think that's the silver bullet that is going to resolve it, because as I read the piece, he was not saying we need to go in and sort the rascals out. He was saying if they can reach an agreement, which we need to be promoting, then perhaps this would be a useful way from Israel's point of view as well as the Palestinians. But I will tell you, something has to be done. I'm actually slightly more optimistic than I was a month ago. And it's just a feeling here. But I have worked on a number of negotiations now. I think it has become so horrible that there is becoming, or soon will be, a shock of recognition on both sides that they have to some way get over the hatreds and the what has been the greatest damage, which is the psychological damage on both sides, in the belief there's nobody to negotiate with on the other. I think it's gotten so bad that something is going to have to happen. And I also believe, actually, that Sharon is, despite his diminished political standing now, is the one figure in Israel that could probably pull it off, if he does. And, of course, Nixon doesn't always go to China. So we have to pray this happens.
Last question. I want to go on with the situation in the Middle East. You mentioned that one of the solutions you see for terrorism is all sorts of aid that alleviates misery and so on and so forth. But there seems to me to be a test case of that. In the years that Israel has administered the disputed territories, all the universities in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza were built by Israel. Israel built countless teachers' colleges, vocational schools, teacher training colleges. It connected over 200 villages to water mains, eliminated malaria, so on and so forth. And yet, in spite of the increased modern infrastructure, we see such an upsurge of terrorist hatred, the Palestinian society that is almost Nazified by now, with an anti-Semitism that is chilling. As you know, Israel is under terrorist assault every single day. So there seem to be more profound reasons than economic behind this kind of terrorist hatred. A lot of it seems to be religious, and a lot of it seems to be a totally failed society in which hatred is the only outlet for all the people's frustration. So I'd like you to, if you could address that at all.
Well, if you're right, and of course to some degree you are, and I wasn't implying it's all about poverty, but if you are right, then I fear for the next generation in the whole region, and not just in terms of what's going to happen to those people there, Israelis and Palestinians and others, but because you can see in a lot of ways around the whole region how this is damaging us. And that push on between Saudi Arabia and Iran, Saudi Arabia backing off on Iraq, a push on between Syria and Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. None of this is good. But I wouldn't come to an absolutist conclusion from what you said. First, I don't think we can afford self-fulfilling prophecies of pessimism. I'm just saying that this is helpless. But also, let me refer to, I think you were there. We share some groups, at least one in common, that is very sympathetic to the problems that the Israelis face. Remarks by Dennis Ross, looking back on what had happened over the past few years, in which, of course, he was very strong about Yasser Arafat's performance in the summer of 2000. And Dennis made a point that if I could go back and do again what we did in the first Clinton administration and the second, one of the top three would be to approach the Palestinians differently in the following specific sense. We were so focused on trying to get a settlement of the problem that we were obsessed with the diplomacy, and I don't think we did nearly enough to try to get programs in for the Palestinians, not to end poverty, you don't do that in a few years, but to show the Palestinians that there were practical benefits from the Oslo process. Because one of the results was that they could see all the diplomatic headlines, but they never saw in their actual lives an improvement, and therefore, on their side, the politics of diplomacy became much more difficult. If I may, finally, and I find this a little hopeful, so many of us have an impression that there is some inherent hatred between Arabs and Jews, and that's just the way it is, and it's gone back thousands of years. The fact is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that over the centuries until the 20th century, and even into the 20th century, in fact, Islam and Muslim countries often provided a refuge for Jews who were being more persecuted in Christian countries. This is, I believe, an historical fact. So it is not, I repeat, it is not necessary that that hatred will continue for all time. And again, we could argue it in an academic sense, but in a practical sense, if we assume it's helpless and inherent, then again, I despair for people that we love. Fine. Thank you again for your really quite stunning presentation and your facility with dealing with our questions. I hope that you found that we do, some of us, support the Red Sox, and I hope that you will be back again to give us another insight into current politics, and I hope the audience will join me in thanking you very much for your... Again, a reminder for those who are going to dinner, it's down the hall and on the right. And if you could move fairly...